Reminded that in 1989, when I was brand new at EPA, I made a visit to Detroit to a Ford plant and looked at a battery-powered van in which, quite seriously, the size of the battery looked like a small coffin and took almost a third of the entire storage space. So while we continue to hope for more breakthroughs on batteries, we have come quite a long way in that period, at least on that. Another thought prompted by some of our conversations at the tables for me was about the 300 new communities of a million each planned in China over the next 25 years, which I think they probably will do. And all of the cars, refrigerators, televisions, and the other ancillary development that that would entail bring me back to the points about urbanization here and the need to prepare for it in a much more thoughtful and sustainable way. Well, I would like to welcome now some of the individuals who are making important commitments here. That is really the essence of Clinton Global Initiative. And first, I'd like to invite to the stage Tom Z. Colina, Executive Director of 2020 Vision Education Fund. While the use of plug-in vehicles could help reduce oil consumption and climate pollution without federal incentives, there is a real danger that they won't, that they will remain that significantly more costly than conventional vehicles. The 2020 Vision Education Fund, along with its partners, is committed to organize a new campaign involving representatives from the auto industry, infrastructure providers, grid operators, and NGOs to enhance the adoption of the plug-in vehicle. This campaign seeks to ensure that plug-in vehicles are cheap, easy to use, and green by building support in the new U.S. government administration, in Congress, in the media, in the public, for an effort to influence federal policies and create financial incentives for automakers to produce and consumers to buy plug-in vehicles. Over the course of 3 years, this commitment, costing about $1.5 million, has the potential to have a positive impact on a lot of people, on some 300 million people, you think. So, Tom Collins, congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Good luck.
Thank you.
So it's Tom Colina. Tom Collins is from too many days here and nights, I guess. Peggy Liu and Roland Schodel, would you join me on the stage? Is somebody else? Oh, yeah. How could I overlook you, Jim? You just parachuted in. Jim Rogers, chairman of Duke Energy. Nice to see you here.
Good to see you.
Well, this is a joint enterprise. It's, first of all, Peggy Liu is chairperson of JUICE. That's the Joint U.S.-China Cooperation on Clean Energy. And Jim Rogers is the chairman of Duke Energy. And Roland Schodel is the founder and chief executive officer of Optimal Technologies. JUICE, Duke Energy, and GridPoint, along with their partners, are committing to develop the JUICE China Smart Grid Cooperative to help accelerate smart grid development in China, which actually meets a very large, unmet, and not much discussed need in these conversations so far today. As a key resource, the smart grid can help upgrade current electric power grids and improve the efficient use of energy through communications and modern computing, thereby reducing carbon dioxide emissions. Through this commitment, a series of workshops will be hosted in Beijing, bringing together the most experienced international experts and effective stakeholders in China, and facilitating dialogue among Juice China Smart Grid Cooperative members. Over the course of 1 year, this commitment, which is anticipated to cost about $770,000, will benefit over a billion people by advancing smart grid technology in China. Congratulations. Liz Robbins, owner of Liz Robbins Associates, and Mark Schoeman, president of the Alternative Fuels Group, AFG Incorporated, would you please join me on the stage? Welcome.
Hi. Hi. Welcome.
Nice. With more than 20 years of experience as an inventor and elite-level motorsports engineer, Mark Schoeman, president of AFG, started exploring simpler ways of making diesel fuel from new or used plant oils in 2005, with an aim to devise a plant oil-based diesel that only requires filtering and mixing ingredients and would not release toxic byproducts. Today, AFG has developed simple blending techniques and formulations that can enable individuals to make fuels made of plant oils, including non-food plant oils, such as Jatropha and algae. AFG and Liz Robbins Associates are committing to extend the benefits of such practices in West Africa by developing infrastructure that will enable local populations to grow their own Jatropha plants and to fabricate fuel. This will enable such communities to become more self-reliant and have additional sources of fuel for transport, agriculture, and manufacturing activities. Over the course of 2 years, this commitment will help improve the economic well-being of 20,000 individuals in West Africa. Congratulations. I'm never sure how to pronounce Jatropha.
Nobody knows.
Is it a Spanish word?
I don't know. I think it's Indian.
Yeah. Well done.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Go to it. I recently asked an energy company executive whether a proposal to take all of the CO2 from the entire output of a major Texas utility was practical and realistic, or whether this was pie in the sky. And their answer was, it's absolutely plausible. It's not been done to scale yet, but these kinds of innovations are in our future. I'm now going to honor someone who's actually succeeded in achieving one of the commitments made at an earlier CGI. Jack Hidery, would you please come up on the stage? You here? Welcome. Jack Hidery built his career as an entrepreneur in the finance and technology sectors and is currently focused on clean energy technology and policy. Jack serves on the board of the United States National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado. He is chairman and co-founder of the Freedom Prize Foundation. In New York City, he was a leading proponent of switching over the taxi fleet to high-mileage hybrids. Jack serves as chairman of smarttransportation.org, the coalition that led the effort, and he's been a member of CGI since its inception. You are one of the reasons that we keep coming back.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you. I guess you already got the student letter.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to first recognize somebody that I met at the first CGI who served as an inspiration to me in all my work and the work of our group, and that is Amory Lovins, who I think is here today. Amory, thank you. I met Imrie as he handed me his 3-4 fat books, and I was very appreciative of those because they helped us in a lot of our work. We've had the fortune of being involved with the XPRIZE. We helped with the first XPRIZE, and then we're involved in co-founding the XPRIZE Automotive 100 miles per gallon. But we realized that was not enough. It was not enough to have the technology breakthroughs if we're not going to have deployment. And so we realized there was an opportunity to create another set of prizes, prizes that would not only recognize technology breakthroughs, but deployment breakthroughs. And we specifically wanted those deployments to be recognized by the U.S. government as well, by the federal government. So we committed last year here at CGI to go to the federal government, to the Department of Energy, and ask them for a commitment, for dollars, and for recognition, and for a program that would recognize Americans, companies, cities, schools, and others that make a tremendous effort towards reducing our dependence on oil, reducing our carbon emissions, and moving away from traditional transportation towards smart and clean transportation. Well, through hypnosis, through cajoling, through lots of sweets, we actually convinced them to do so, and the Department of Energy announced with us and with the chairman of the Energy Committee of the Senate, Chairman Jeff Bingaman, the foundation of the Freedom Prizes. Each of these will be in the $1 million range and will recognize different parts of society and different winners in those sectors. We also want to give a quick update. I think you see some pictures here. Quick update on our previous commitment to extend our work in the yellow hybrid taxi cabs, which I'm sure you may have seen. Has anyone ridden in a yellow hybrid cab? Okay. Well, there's now 1,500 on the road, up from 200 last year when we were here last year. And we further made a commitment last year, which we fulfilled this past year, to get all the black cars, the town cars, those fancier cars that you see around New York City, to get a new law passed that would change those. We succeeded in April of this year in passing a law 7-0 to get all the black cars changed over. And starting January 1st of this coming year, you'll see a 4-year period of changeover of every single town car in New York City to high mileage hybrids. I want to recognize the participation of Ozarkar, who I also met at CGI, in helping us to formulate that plan. Ozarkar is one of the leaders in that particular field. I also want to recognize the Sierra Club, NRDC, and many others who we again met here at CGI and were instrumental in making all this happen. All this happens through coalitions, not by any one individual or any one organization. Finally, let me just close with our thoughts for this coming year. We recognize that there are over 250 million cars in America today. There is no way, no matter how hard we all try, no matter how many consumers buy plug-in hybrids, plug-in electrics, all kinds of new cars, to simply have a big dent in 250 million cars. And so because of that, we would like to have an accelerated vehicle recovery program, AVR, which is done in Texas, California, and some provinces in Canada today, where people are paid a small premium that to take their old clunkers off the road. You can call it cash for clunkers. In our shop, we call it Jack's Jalopy Law. And these laws, if done federally, which we think there's a possibility in the new Congress, can begin to take the older cars off the road and create a vacuum for the newer technologies coming aboard. Thank you very much, CGI, for your help and your assistance. It's been a great platform to get this done. Thank you very much. Let me say, in the back of the room, we have some books of Tom Friedman's, which highlight the work that was mentioned. We also have, from the United Nations, was kind to give us 250 copies of their UNDP climate change report, free for the taking in the back. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. You know, it strikes me that prizes have been an underappreciated way to stimulate change. World Wildlife Fund was looking for a turtle-protecting fishing device and offered a prize for it and publicized it on the web, and within 7 months for $25,000 had from a fisherman a precisely effective, very practical new technique that has been widely introduced now. So that's often quicker than doing RFPs and getting involved in a lot of extensive research and consultation. So congratulations on that and on the other commitments that you're very well on the way to achieving. Well, I look around the room and realize how much, I want to say energy, but how much expertise and resourcefulness there is here. It's very exciting. These commitments are exciting. And thanks to you all for what you're doing to keep them coming. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back our panel to the stage.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we now enter the lightning round here at this phase of CGI. We've had a chance to have a look at some of your first questions. Actually, one thing I'll do before I get into the this particular panel, a programming note. Many of you will know there's a climate breakfast tomorrow morning. Ira Magaziner is due to speak about, at that. Amory Lovins, who was recognized a moment ago, wonderful person in addition to being a tremendous energy visionary, has also kindly agreed to share his thoughts at that breakfast. So please do attend. I know you'll find it worthwhile. Now, the questions were fast and furious, I must say, and there's been no shyness on the part of this audience, which I'm not surprised by, including some tough questions. So I'm delighted about that. Why don't we start? Nancy, let's start with you. We talked about quite a bit about cities and the urban future, and with good reason, I think, as many of you know why. But what about rural areas? How do we ensure that those aren't forgotten when we're planning for this urban future?
You know, I think we use cities as a shorthand, and we should really talk about metropolitan areas. And one thing to think about is that there's a lot of rural area within larger metropolitan areas, one. And then two, so cities and rural areas are really connected. So the most people on Earth live in greater metropolitan areas, and the success of the city and the attached and associated metropolitan area, which are is often rural, are really connected. So I don't think it will be forgotten.
No, but just to put a sharp point on the question, won't the same policies that we focus on in cities not work or make things worse in areas that are outside, however you define the city?
Well, if you're talking about transportation, the transportation needs might be different because you're talking about managing congestion and air quality in the cities. So what the rural areas need are, you know, basic roads. You know, in development terms, let's talk about poor countries. In development terms, the joke is now the most successful development strategy in a poor country is probably a paved road and a bus ticket. Meaning, you know, go to a city, right? In the United States, if you think about it, what you need are markets. Well, or worldwide, what you need are markets. You need at least roads to get your goods and services to the country or to get yourself to the city.
John, Mello, you had a perspective on this.
Yeah, my perspective is more the economic development perspective or the opportunity. If I think about South America, Brazil specifically, and some of the countries we're exploring in Africa, there's an opportunity to produce 180 billion gallons of fuel in those markets and provide great sustainable prosperity in those markets. So I think of the agenda we're on as more of, at minimum, a hemispheric agenda and beyond as a way to really provide a sustainable future, both in those markets, kind of connecting the tropics to the growth of the world.
Well, sticking with that theme, Ted Boylan from the audience wants to know, I have 2,000 large tractor-trailer trucks on the road today. Is anybody working on a way to power these large trucks? I wondered what you thought about it. I might turn to our other John as well to pursue this.
Yeah, we may have two different perspectives on this, but that's why I think it's a portfolio of energy solutions. And a reason why we focused on diesel and jet is we actually think the transportation fuels around the world focused on jet and diesel for on-road transport needs a better solution. So our focus is, yes, those tractor trailers need a solution. It should be a renewable diesel, and we have a great renewable diesel that's very affordable and sustainable to serve their needs.
John Bryson, what about electricity as a fuel? Could that be part of this solution? And if so, just bundling in another one of the questions from the audience, if we electrify transport, doesn't that just mean we're going to burn more coal?
Well, let me start with the first. There is a good deal of work underway about electrification approaches to trucks. We at Southern California Edison, I'm told, have the largest private electric fleet in the country. We have right now 25 prototype electric field trucks, so major trucks. The truck-trailer combination, I don't know about. Eaton International has developed those. General Motors may be working on some of that. Let me turn to the coal-fired point. If we do electrification, as a fuel for automobiles, don't we burn more coal? Isn't that a bad thing? I touched on that at the outset. It's really an important question because people instinctively would be concerned about that, and rightly so.
And the point here being the U.S. electricity grid is, what, about 55% coal?
50% coal, 50% coal.
So it's not an unreasonable question, to be sure.
No, it's absolutely right question. So a major study was done, and I asked that my friends at Natural Resources Defense Council, some of you know I was a founder of that a long time ago, but I've done other things since, to join in the study. And so the two-year study is done modeling four major electric systems, regions around the country, 365 days a year, looking at the total impacts as quantitatively as they possibly could, and reached the conclusion that even if you don't assume a meaningful cleaning up of the electric systems, which, by the way, are certain to and absolutely must happen, the cleanup, but even if you don't assume that, moving to electric transportation significantly is an overall vast net improvement. So even assuming coal's in the mix.
Right. So on the CO2 point, it's worth doing now. It sounds like on local pollution, certainly electricity is a zero local emission fuel. But you're saying it's the old joke used to be electric vehicles are pollute somewhere else cars, right?
That's right.
But it sounds like...
So this study's available.
Studies, and it's an excellent study. I recommend it to everyone.
Maybe could I just say, Vijay, the tie-in point
briefly.
Here, just real briefly. So another thing that electric transportation does is... it drives a lot of investment in batteries. Batteries, in turn, are key to widespread adoption of renewable fuels. So they're kind of virtuous cycles here. They are also key to the smart grid steps that we referred to.
Absolutely.
You can't have them
enabling technologies
without the smart grid. So a lot of things fit together.
Well, Beth, good news for you when thinking about your Volt that John's teed up, that it's environmentally sound to plug into the grid. Alas, there does remain to be some skeptics in the audience, and one of them asks, why isn't the Volt powered by flex fuel? Will it be in the future? And why aren't you building 100% flex fuel cars like your own company's division in Brazil is doing?
With respect to the Volt, the beauty of it and the elegant solution with the extended range electric vehicle is we are initially designing it with a small gasoline engine that will generate electricity after it goes 40 miles on the battery, and then you can plug it in if you commute less than 40 miles, which about 80% of the U.S. public does daily. But we have plans in place for those to be biofuel engines, could be biodiesel, looking at extended range electric vehicles that will have fuel cells. So it doesn't really matter where you get the electricity from, and so that's why we want to have all these various options. So you will have a biofuel version as well.
So it's a platform that can be used for whichever direction the fuel market goes in future. Very good. I think mastermind of our session, David Sandalo, is coming up with some more questions, so let me give him the stage.
Thanks, BJ. Thanks, everybody. I just actually want to start by thanking a friend and hero of mine, Bill Riley, whose title did get somewhat short shrift when he was brought on stage, but he wears so many hats. So a founder of Aqua International, a partner at TPG, a board chair emeritus of WWF, a former U.S. EPA administrator, and a real hero for the planet. So thanks, Bill, for everything you're doing. Fantastic ideas coming at us at the theme team back there. Just to repeat a few of them. First, using technology to reduce the need for transportation, video conferencing and telecommuting, that got a lot of attention. Somebody said, get us out of the skies, reduce air travel. Somebody suggested replicating the Paris bicycle program, and Mayor Delano of Paris is going to be on this stage tomorrow morning for anybody who wants to hear more about that. Location-efficient mortgages that value homes near mass transit. Overhaul freight shipping with use of rail and water transport. Pay-as-you-go car insurance. This is a really good idea if anybody's interested and unfamiliar with it. Look into this. It's very powerful. Focus on smarter transportation, better logistics, congestion pricing, urban fast-pass ride-sharing systems. Somebody suggested increasing fuel efficiency standards to 50 miles per gallon by 2020. Interested here with Beth. Thanks about that. And a number of comments along these lines mandating a floor on gas prices. Somebody said keep oil over $100 a barrel. Another one for Beth, tie the bailout of auto manufacturers to improved energy performance. Restructuring taxes to provide incentives. And somebody said flip federal transit funding to 80% transit, 20% road in the United States. Feel free to applaud, really. some of the gems that we like back there, some of the gems we like back there, somebody said, remind the Department of Transportation in the U.S. that they are the Department of Mobility, not the Department of Cars and Highways. Give away bicycles, reduce obesity. And my personal favorite, translate Vijay's book Zoom into Chinese.
Thank you. Excellent. And I didn't plant her in the audience either, as you know. She's a distinguished expert in her own right. Thank you so much, David. Now, we have a range of questions and themes, but a number of them, at least at the start, a lot of them do look at policy, and I want to get to that in a moment. But a lot of them also talk about behavior. Behavior changes. We've talked in terms of technologies and techno fixes, but doesn't that in some way let us off the hook a bit? Is the lifestyle that we choose to have sustainable? Is the automobile compatible? Even with all the fixes that might happen with fuels, can we continue to fly the way we do? These are tough questions. How do we influence lifestyle choices, and how does that cut in with sustainability? Your perspective on this, Nancy, and I'll turn to Beth next in terms of in the role of consumer and in the marketplace. But let's start with you.
Okay.
Again, well, let's briefly, just given the nature of time constraints.
Yeah, okay. Well, I do think that if you want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, you have to get at behavior with some kind of signal. And when gasoline prices went up, people drove less. It was really clear. And, you know, for a couple of decades, we thought that wouldn't happen, and it did. So I'm with whoever suggested that we put a floor on the price of fuel. And if you have to rebate it back to people through their earned income tax credit or whatever, let's get people used to paying more.
Sure. So the insight is you accept the premise that the power of the price signal
Absolutely.
To influence behavior. And it sounds like some form of revenue neutral or refundable kind of carbon tax or something else. British Columbia, for example, has just done, very courageous, I think, a revenue neutral carbon tax, and they started off by cutting a refund check Yep. to show people that it wasn't a scheme for big government or anything else.
And the variable pricing on insurance, as David mentioned, is the same. It's like we want to make the cost of driving, you want to pay the variable cost of driving, and then people will drive less. They'll find that they can do less of it.
Beth, historically, Detroit companies have, in theory, supported carbon taxes as an alternative to CAFE and other approaches, but it is always said in quiet corridors by people like me that it's great to support because you know it'll never pass. What do you think about the price signal versus the very much more real prospect of regulation like CAFE and other kinds of approaches?
As mentioned, price signals do work. So a price on carbon is very important. That's why GM is part of the U.S. cap to try to figure out in the United States, can we put a cap and trade program in place that will actually put a price on carbon so that people will understand those issues. With respect to transportation, it is a combination of what the auto manufacturers can do from a technology standpoint, fuels and consumer behavior, vehicle miles traveled. So there are three legs of the stool. It's very hard. We can do everything to get low carbon fuels out there. We can do everything from a technology standpoint. We, you know, have the 40% increase in fuel economy, that very tough challenge that everybody signed up to do. But if people have cheap fuel, they will continue to drive. So we cannot drive down CO2 unless you have all those pieces together. And really, price signals is the main way to do that.
Let me take a straw poll. We've heard a couple of advocates of price signals. How many of you in this room would support a carbon tax as an approach to handling this question, whether it's structured as an oil tax or more broadly a carbon tax? Okay. How many of you are willing to go out there on television and put your company's names on the line? This is a question for you too, Beth, for your CEO, and argue the case so that political leaders will have some cover? Because in my experience, and I've challenged a number of the environmental leaders in the U.S. on this, they have not been sufficiently courageous in walking the talk the way that some of the European counterparts have. And you know that historically we have a very different environmental approach in Europe, often based on price signals, externalities, taxation, and green eco-taxation reform that is only beginning to arrive in the U.S. Does anyone here, including the gentlemen who haven't spoken on this point, see any political sign at all that this might happen?
Well, just to get them off the hook for a second, with respect to the political world, I think we all have looked at the fact that people are very interested in doing something with respect to the price of carbon. And it seems like right now there is momentum on a cap and trade program. So how can you get all the sectors, including transportation, into a cap and trade program that can address the environmental and economic issues? Now, that's a major challenge, but that seems much more doable than trying to have consumers in the marketplace understand what a carbon tax or a gas tax. People in America do not like that.
Cap and trade is important. I think we ought to move to it. I think a carbon tax would have many positives, but certainly every time we've addressed it in the Congress, we've been advised that's a waste of time. Third rail of politics, maybe the dramatic changes of the past week or two will lead to more radical thinking on a lot of fronts, but cap and trade is effectively a taxing mechanism, and we support that, so do broadly people, I think, increasingly across U.S. industry.
Sticking with utilities for just a moment, there's a lot of question about incentives. And getting to the point here made about how do we encourage mobility rather than specific modes like cars, I think I see the hidden hand of Amory Lovins there in talking about mobility or what he likes to say, cold beer and hot showers rather than electrons. Utilities often around the world are paid to pump out more electrons. That's not true in California. Can you give us very briefly any insight on how to shift that mode of getting incentives right to deliver the good things energy makes possible, including in transport, rather than a commodity supply-driven approach to thinking about the problem?
Yeah, that's a simple thing to do.
Microphone?
I was head of the California Public Utilities Commission, time of the second oil price spike. Amory advised me, we changed the mechanism in California, so no California utility depends on revenues to have to serve shareholders well. That's simply a neutralized point, has been for nearly 30 years now, Amory, and it works. And so you have the biggest energy efficiency programs in California, the lowest usage, and healthy utilities.
Nancy, you wanted to jump in on that?
I just wanted to say just factually, you know, at the cap and trade at the level that the Congress is considering it, that won't send a price signal that's strong enough to change behavior of driving. So, unfortunately,
not for the transport sector.
Not for the transport sector.
And certainly not if it's full of Swiss cheese, as is likely to happen.
Even without the Swiss cheese, the price won't be high enough. So we are going to have to do something either on raise the gas tax or something else for the transport sector specifically to change behavior.
But transport has something unique, doesn't it? Unlike the electricity sector, where we can say there are carbon externalities and local pollution, you also have geopolitical externalities involved in some of the costs of foreign policy implications of being addicted to oil that might justify other kinds of policies on top of what's in the electricity sector. At least that's the argument I would put forward. Let's see how far it gets. I do think, though, as Tom Friedman highlights in his work, the GeoGreen coalition he's talked about, it's not only the environmentalists, but also many people in the national security right who have been quite concerned about reliance on oil that are willing to take a look at transportation. In the time remaining, I wonder if we could address one final point, and that is opportunity and innovation. Well, there was mention made of the Automotive X Prize and the great work that Jack Kettery is doing. How can we see an opportunity to build a renaissance in the heartland of America, tap the ingenuity that we've seen transform IT, biotech, a number of other industries here in these oldest and stodgiest of industries, with apologies to Beth.
I thought you were talking utilities when you said that.
What? Nicely done, nicely done.
Actually, BJ, I'll jump in with respect to the fact that we are very focused on, again, the reinvention of the automobile and giving opportunities. So while there are tremendous challenges in our business right now, there is tremendous investment going in, whether it's, you know, the bio green diesel or biofuels, electrification. So there's really, as you say, a renaissance of transportation, and I think we all have to be a part of finding the solution.
John Miller, very briefly.
I think innovation can come from the strangest places. We started off to really address malaria. We're now focused on saving 500,000 to 600,000 children a year. And as a result of that, we've discovered a great green diesel. So I think we should stay open, technology neutral, and actually really look at solutions where they're not typically seen.
I think that's a fantastic point to close on, that the nature of innovation will be bottom-up, even though I think we've certainly established today there is an important role for leadership, from the environmental community, from business, and from government in leveling the playing field, removing the distortions, the subsidies, the perversions that have kept us in a particular way of doing our energy and automotive approaches. But nevertheless, I remain hopeful, and I hope you'll share my view that with smart people like these working on this, we'll be able to tackle this problem. Please join me in giving them a hand.
Ladies and gentlemen, our workshop is now concluded. Your next workshops.